two great books, very readable. I've just taken two of them on the Greek society that you haven't been involved with this year, that sometimes we have. At least some of them have been involved in Greek philosophy. Stringfellow Bar, The Will of Zeus. That's the Greek society, Stringfellow Bar. It reads like a novel, and it's a great and good summary of the Greek spirit and what happened there. Stringfellow Bar, great teacher too. One of those who developed the St. John's program, and then as it moved out to Phoenix with another school and the great books and so on. He was in on that and got involved. Stringfellow Bar, The Will of Zeus. And the other one from the Greek society, Werner Jaeger, who is a philosopher in his own right and gets included in contemporary philosophy books and so on, but he's a professor at large at Harvard, and Paideia is his great work, and Volume 2 is the greatest in that. So if you just were to read Volume 2, you'd get the whole Socratic tradition, Plato, Aristotle, Paideia, the ideals of Greek culture. But here is their lifestyle enrichment under a pagan society. And I mention this because the minute you get into Kierkegaard, you've got all kinds of antecedents. To read Kierkegaard with no knowledge of Hegel, no knowledge of the Greeks, to just start out cold in them, and it seems hard. And this is your problem always in any philosophy that you're going to take. You can't read anyone without almost having already read them before you read them. Now, I said this once, and I got misunderstood by one of the men on our faculty who wanted to give me a special lecture on Kant. And it isn't because I haven't read him in some detail and discussed him at length with other people who read him much more. But you have always a lot of vocabulary that's involved that will seem strange to you and will throw you, and then you won't go on and you say it's tough. Well, it takes a little time to get into any philosopher and to get into him, because he's always involved with others. But I think one of the easiest philosophers to read and get excited about is Kierkegaard, simply because his beginning, where he begins, the point of departure for him, is very clearly stated when he's still at about your age. And he's got a summer retreat up at Gilalai, which is a lovely place in the north end of Ceylon, the big island in which Copenhagen is. There's some little lakes up in the north, and then you get up and there are big bluffs overlooking the sea, and you can look over, you can see the coast of Sweden in the distance, and it's a very lovely place, really. And as he's there, walking back and forth, and they've got a big stone up there as a memory of where this suddenly came to him, that after all, philosophy is not something for which you get a degree to teach to other people so they can get a degree to teach other people philosophy, which is the way it has generally been used in the West, held to just a little elite group who know the vocabulary and who create a little happy few, and they're the philosophers. But philosophy is for every man, because every man has to live his own life. And his own life is what philosophy is about. And when this hit him, he wrote it down very beautifully and lucidly, and when he became aware, he said, "The only truth that counts is the truth for me." Now this seems to be a rather obvious thing, but it's not obvious. Many people have never ever reached that point. Many of the things in Kierkegaard are something that only a little child or a genius would see. When you were little children, you could see it, I think, most of you, and then you grew away from it. You got trained out of it. Like, for instance, just one little statement of Kierkegaard on how could God, the Almighty God, create a creature who was independent of him? Who else? I mean, it's a perfect answer, absolutely perfect answer. It takes an Almighty God to create a creature who was independent of him. Who else? Only a child or a genius would have seen it. And this is him over and over again. Like I said, the only truth that counts, that matters, is the truth for me, the truth by which I live. And this seems so obvious, you know, and yet it just simply has not been what's been acceptable. As he says in one of his beautiful little paragraphs, that he takes the word from the Greek Septuagint Bible, what you got, Selah, in your old King James. You know, you hit the Psalm Selah, and the word in that your Greek Bible, the Septuagint for that, is diapsilamata, a pause. And these little pauses that he writes, just little tiny paragraphs that are beautiful. You'll see them in either or, where they're included in that. And they're just beautiful little segments for just moments for reflection. And they're a good place to begin, because every one of them in itself is adequate to think about for quite a while, really. But in these little pauses in which he writes this, philosophy has generally been the task of building a castle by a man who lives in a doghouse alongside of it. No, it's an obvious thing. See, he's got a projection of something that's really nice, but he isn't living in it. And if he can't live in it, who can? You know, maybe it isn't even livable. These diplomata are fun. One of them that I love very much is where he said he was granted the wish by the gods. They took him into Mount Olympus, and there in presence of all the gods, he was granted the permission for any wish he might desire. And it was obvious the wish he'd want, of course, the last laugh. They were not so prosaic as to say, your wish is granted, but the Olympian heavens rocked with laughter. Because after all, isn't it the last laugh that you want? Everybody. I gave a sermon on that over the old Columbia Broadcasting System. They said it was their second most popular sermon they'd ever had in terms of response from people writing into it. But it's obviously touched a deep chord in everybody. Well, those diapsomata, you can start reading them if you want to. The fellow is impossible not to enjoy reading because he's a master of style. He has a delightful way of allowing you to be involved with him as he's thinking about it. So you aren't being, like I am doing now, talking to you, but you're being involved with it. And he's always addressing my reader, or whom he calls the individual, that individual who responds to me, that individual. And he's speaking, and you feel you're caught up, and you're that individual for whom he exists and for whom he's speaking, and who at this moment has come to life so that you can hear what he has to say. And that's the way he captures you. It's a good way to do it. He speaks a lot about that individual, and he's really addressing that individual and how you can live then in your own individuality. David Swenson is one of the great Kierkegaard scholars who really introduced him, more than a man named Hollander, to American society. Discovered him in the old Scandinavian library over on Franklin Avenue, and realized he was suddenly in the presence of one of the world geniuses. Reading him, because he wasn't in English yet, Hollander put him in English, produced by the Oklahoma Press way back when, I think Oklahoma was, or Texas, a little bit of some of these little short things, and that's about all it was in English. But Swenson just was taken, and I would say that, for instance, when he'd be speaking, for instance, to us as students, he would say, the calling to be you is a greater calling than any man can succeed with in one lifetime. but that is no small thing to be you, and it's no easy task to accept it as a call. And Kierkegaard gives you more help in this than any other person I know in the history of philosophy. Isn't this how you feel about him, Al? Mm-hmm. That's how I feel about him. Mm-hmm. And that's why he's worthwhile. He gives you support, in other words, to fight off me, to fight off your father, your mother, to fight off your husband or wife, to be you. And this is what he's concerned about, because there's nothing more important in your life, after all, than to be you. Is there? Really? And yet everything is aligned against you, you see? Because you're difficult to understand if you're you. You're not an echo of me. When I'm lecturing in class and your tests, I expect to hear what I've been lecturing about, or why were you there, see? Give me my praises back to me again. Don't find your own on your knees with the Holy Spirit. That's too difficult for me when I'm correcting it. But I mean, everything is organized against you on this, you see. This is a natural thing. And that's why I want to introduce it. Now, Al went to David Swenson when he had graduated from the seminary. He'd already taught at Augustana College after he graduated from there. Went to seminary. When he finished the seminary, he went over to see David Swenson, and David Swenson said, what do you want to come and study under me for? If Al had said, I want to get a PhD at that time, I don't think David would let him in. But he said, I just want 2 years to think. Read and think. And of course, the minute David Swenson just glows and says, you're on, which is what he did for 2 years. Not for a degree, not so he could teach in some college or seminary, but simply for that opportunity to get this kind of a continual reflection in his own inner being, so nothing could have ever, I was thinking about this morning, one thing about Al, I can't remember that he has ever operated in any way outside the contours of the particular personhood that God has given to him. In other words, I've never heard a false note from him. He's never pushed, he's never had any affectation, I've never heard any kind of aggressiveness, and so he's always had time for everybody. Nobody in our history in our church has had more time for people. He admires others who have time for people like Fritz Norris as I do. But he, with all his writing, his wife said one thing she thinks so terrific about him, he gets through with these situations, people saw him, it's 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, he'll still sit down at 2 o'clock in the morning and write another chapter in the book. They may have to come over and get him out of the parsonage to come over and get going for the church because they've already started the service and he isn't there. And that has happened. It never bugs him, and peculiar enough, it never bothers his congregation. They think it's wonderful. And it is wonderful. Really, isn't it?
Well, that's not quite true.
Oh, it's pretty true.
You could ask Nora. She'd, you know, she wouldn't confirm everything.
Oh, but it's pretty close. She would go pretty much on. Nora was the one telling me how much she admired you for the fact that
yeah.
No matter how tired you are, that chapter gets done when you get back. 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. They aren't people who go to bed early.
No.
Well, he can introduce you to this. This is a delightful book which you can look at if you want to, just to see the kinds of reference that Kierkegaard uses in terms of the various subjects that get involved in his books. Actually, now what's happened is that Edna and Howard Hong have been spending practically most of their later lifetime, the last 10 years, in getting into English much of this. But you would discover, if you were, for instance, to look at the term Socrates in here, it's simply amazing. There are literally over 1,000 references to Socrates in his writing. And Socrates meant that much to him, because for him, Socrates is the figure who continually clarifies what Christianity is, because most of what goes under Christianity, as he says, doesn't even get as far as Socrates. And he's right. This whole liberalism, this whole so-called social gospel you've heard and so on, it didn't get as far as Socrates. And this is what's so interesting. He uses Socrates, in other words, to be a kind of enzyme to clarify this whole chemical confusion of where is Christianity. Or again, as he says in the Apsomata, one of his cute little images again, that it's like a great cathedral in which Christianity has been preached for 200 years and you're hearing so many echoes coming from all the corners for 2,000 years, you can't hear what it is. You just get the echo. You've got so many illustrations like this. They're all fun. Somebody just introduced another new one to me recently on women, which I won't use here, but he's not the best guy to get into the women's lib thing. We won't do that with him. He had a little feeling that really you should not expect little children and women to be reflective, and they're excused from the reflective process. Now, this is, of course, Mary should be here on this one. She feels for that very beautifully. But you got a lecture from her yesterday. I was just telling Al at when I was down with the profs down there at Columbus, and now they were saying that maybe the most tough-minded theologian we've got in the church today is Mary. And I used to say, well, she's got a man's mind. If I said it today, they'd string me up in the nearest tree. She's just a tough-minded theologian. And Kierkegaard should have met her, but he didn't have the chance, unfortunately. I think the nice little girl he was in love with, you may want to tell the story about, didn't have that type of a mind. My feeling about anybody who became the wife of the guy who was the governor of the Virgin Islands wouldn't be much given to reflection. But that broke up. Al will carry it from here, but wherever you start, I just want to say, wherever you want to start with philosophy, you're always involved with a lot of other reference, and you can't escape this. And it's not impossible. Al had a good illustration I've never run into in Kierkegaard yesterday, that if you're going to stop to each one of them, all you got is a bunch of parentheses. And the minute you mention, you got another parentheses. I always say footnotes, and you can't read the text. So you just have to assume that there's going to be a certain amount of this that during a period of a lifetime, you're going to become more acquainted with it as you go. But the great thing about Kierkegaard, where he stands for in this time, and if you just run into him in Muggeridge, and Muggeridge was taken with him from Howard Hong's translation of the journals, actually, which he reviewed and then got into it. But this had something to do with his own conversion at 68. And like he says, this man, in his own remarkable way, that stood back there in the beginning of the 19th century and saw ours, and saw just where mankind was heading. And that's the advantage of getting with some of these good thinkers, is that then you're not driving blind. You may be not like the horror of some of the curves and some of the possibilities of the wreckage ahead, but at least you've got some information. And Kierkegaard gives it to you, and it's good information. Well, I'll take over, except for one more thing. Every time you're with people who have some information, if they are people who've got a little bit of integrity, they should tell you, where can you get into this the most easily, the most simply, and at the same time, the most honestly? And nobody does as good a job as this Malinchuk a Latvian who has spent his life with Kierkegaard in Copenhagen, just moved in and has spent it with him. And he's written this little book, Kierkegaard's Way to the Truth, which is published by all, of all things, by Augsburg. But it's the best little introduction to Kierkegaard you can find, really. It's really excellent. Just a superb little book. And that much about Kierkegaard, everyone should know, because you simply can't escape him. The 20th century has become a division between the two parties who go with Kierkegaard in one direction or with him in another. They go with him to become pagans like Sartre and that whole gang that you all know about, Camus and so on, who pick him up from Heidegger, although Heidegger himself has gone in the direction once more of the Christian route with Heidegger in his older years now, and has become quite much on the opposite side. But that's when Sartre studied under him and got his doctorate, he was over on the opposite end of the stick. Or else they go into a very specific and quite orthodox Christian expression. Kierkegaard actually corrected the radicals within the Lutheran movement who wanted to use the young Luther against the old Luther. And the Kierkegaard scholars stopped that movement right on its heels, because what became so evident, if you took the younger Luther's attitude that God loves you in the light of what you are to become, he really doesn't love you. He only loves what he's going to make of you. If he doesn't love you as you are and as you come right now, you don't have his love. And that's one thing that comes through tremendously clear in Kierkegaard. He and the older Luther at that point come down solid. It's a Christianity that's centered in the cross and in a God for sinners, a God for bad people, as David Swensen would put it. Mm-hmm. And that is very beautiful in him, in spite of the fact that no one in the whole history of ideas has strained so hard and given so much intensity to give as extreme an expression of what discipleship means as Kierkegaard has done. So much so that I differ with Suze, president of the Kierkegaard Society. He thinks Kierkegaard was insane at the end. I don't. I believe that Kierkegaard all the way through remained consistent with his own ideas. He wanted no disciples, and he really plays the game to the end by showing his clay feet so that he won't have any in the final blast that he comes out with on some of his final writing. Enough for an introduction. Al has much more information than I do.
No, I don't, but he's gotten disciples finally, whether he likes it or not.
Yeah, he said he would get them. They'd want to make...
It took him 100 years before he got any, well, practically. I'm not an expert in Kierkegaard. I, in the early years, I was able to give lectures on him and with some confidence, but there are so many rivals now that I'm out of business. I don't do this sort of thing very often. But as Carol said, it was my good fortune to be introduced to him by David Swensen. You'll notice that this book is dedicated to David Swensen and to Lowry, who began translating him and introduced us to the English world to him. But I remember David Swensen saying that there were two great thinkers in the world. One was Plato of Athens, and the other was Kierkegaard of Copenhagen. But the world hadn't discovered Kierkegaard yet, but they would. And he said they were great for many reasons, but for two particular reasons. One was they were both tremendous dialecticians. That is, they could think conceptually and logically. They weren't muddled thinkers, and they dealt with great issues. And the second thing was that besides being dialecticians, they were poets. They could think in the concrete, so that the writings of Kierkegaard, much of it is just full of these things that Carol called attention to, the concrete pictures, where the truth gets incarnate, really. Now, the advantage of that is that those of us who are not dialecticians, who would not be able nor interested probably in dealing conceptually with a lot of stuff, we hang on to these pictures that he gives us and understand through the pictures some of the things that a dialectician would spend a lot of time in conceptual thought. I was just, when Carol and I were talking yesterday, I guess we got into this because of the Missouri Synod situation where they're bogged down on the nature of authority now. And they'll get out of that, but it'll take a little time But I said it reminds me of what Kierkegaard called the parenthesis hound, the dog that gallops in a parenthesis. But once he's out of the parenthesis, he doesn't gallop much anymore. And I thought of supposing I were preaching on the text, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son." And then I paused and I said, which, as the Bible says, you know, and the Bible is true for the following 10 reasons. And then I'm off galloping into a whole lot of reasons why the Bible is reliable, and I never get back to John 3:16. You know, I get lost in the parentheses because I've gotten too excited over in the parentheses. Well, that's a quick picture, the kind of thing that that Kierkegaard deals with. Well, anyway, I was fascinated by Dr. Swenson, or by Professor Swenson. The fact of the matter is that Professor Swenson himself had only a Bachelor of Arts degree. He began by teaching mathematics and went from mathematics to logic and from logic into the larger fields of philosophy.
That his I
chief,
never knew.
His chief interest being the philosophy of religion, finally. Yeah, and I remember, and he was head of the department, and a young PhD in the department said to me, when I talk to Swenson, I feel like an insurance salesman. That is, I just don't feel competent compared with the vast erudition that he had. But it was, as Carol said, it was knowledge not for the sake of knowledge, just but for the sake of the person. So it was always had a feeling that Swenson had something he would die for. And he was the only man in the department at the time that I felt that way about. The others had truth out here somewhere where they were examining it like a person would examine a cadaver in a post-mortem, you know, something out here, being objective. And Swenson was never objective. He was profoundly subjective. That is, he had the competence of an objective scholar, but it meant something to him. That is, everything meant something to him. He was committed to something.
I'd like to tell one story here to illustrate that, which the kids have heard that are here, but some of you are new to this and have not. We were in a philosophy club one night discussing suffering. What is suffering? And Professor Castell from the psychology department was the chairman. He's a very cocky guy. And he came up to this deaf instrument that was on a wheelbarrow that Swenson put around so he could hear. And he yelled into the instrument, "And what do you consider, Swenson?" Because we were really hung up. We were discussing from a chapter from Beyond Conscience by T.V. Smith, who was a congressman, also professor of philosophy down at the University of Chicago. And Swenson said, "Well, if you want to know what suffering is, ask the man in the street." And that was all he said.
Yeah.
And then Costell got angry. He says, "Don't be so enigmatic. Explain yourself, you know." And so I didn't think I was being enigmatic. I thought I was just answering your question. If you want to know what suffering is, find out from the man in the street. What is he complaining about? That's what suffering is for him, isn't it? He says, "All I know that for me, all that I've received is too good for me, a sinner." Bang. It was, if I ever felt like hell had opened and all the demons were crawling around, it was that moment. And he really had it. And Costello was furious. He was just red. He says, "You and your conviction of sin, that's pure egotism." Well, in a sense it is. To think you're important enough to be a sinner is egotism. Well, that is. I mean, that's one fundamental presupposition of the Christian faith. You're important enough to be a sinner. Buckminster Fuller's making that point today. He said, "Very few people anymore are important enough to be a sinner." "I am. I know. He says, I can sin." And, but if you think you're just manipulated by everything you were born to or been brought up to, you can't be a sinner. You're just a manipulated person. But then he went on from there. He said, he said a little bit more to that, but then, he says, "That's good for me to hear," Swenson said. "Sometimes I'm tempted to think otherwise, you know." And then I, of course, rose to the defense. Yeah, because Costello says, "You and your conviction of sin, I'm convicted of my own righteousness." And I said, "Well, Professor Costello, you just said you're God." "That's great," I said. "Try acting like him. God is love. Try loving and see how much love you got." And he turned to me and says, "Words of wise out of the mouth of babes," and then we broke up. But there's how Swenson operated, see. He never allowed you to escape the concrete situation, which, first of all, is whom? You, after all.
Well, as most of you know...
Okay, sorry to interrupt, but that just illustrates for you his method.
That He died at the age of 42 of a stroke. So he was a young, he never married. As Carol said, he was engaged to Regina Olson and the scholars have all puzzled why he broke the engagement. But he didn't feel that he had the call to be a husband. And he was a person of melancholy. He was, his father was quite old when he was born. His father was a rich wool merchant, so that Kierkegaard never did have to work. He lived off the patrimony that he had, which gave him plenty of time to write and engage in studies. And but his father was a brilliant guy, a great imagination and ability to articulate. And it was said that when Kierkegaard was a little boy and he wanted to go down on the streets of Copenhagen at night and see how things were, what things were happening, his father would take him by the hand and they'd walk around the house and inside of the house, and his father would describe the sights, and that this boy Soren would rather walk with his father around and listen to his father describe these imaginary sights than go out on the streets of Copenhagen, because his father had that gift of description. Well, this gift of imagination was Soren's too, but they were both melancholy people. They looked on the really on the sad side more than on the joyous side. And one time Kierkegaard, in describing his role, said that he was in the life of the church, he was a corrective. He was not a model. You should not imitate him. He said, much like a cook needs a touch of spice in a something she's making. It'd be wonderful for her to get that touch of spice in there, but it would be disastrous if she's got the idea the whole thing ought to be spice. Or that a daub of red on a canvas for an artist was something that was necessary, but supposing the artist got the notion red was so nice, he'd make it all red. That would destroy the whole business. And then he talked about the great choir, that the choir is made up of the jubilant sopranos and the strident altos and the lovely tenors, but also the choir needs the basso profundo, the suffering one, the melancholy one, in order to make the whole something beautiful. And he thought of himself in that connection, and more than he ought to have, because he pitted himself against the established church with a good deal of venom. In fact, he told the people that if they wanted one sin less to account for on the day of judgment when they saw God, they should stop going to church and stop supporting this caricature of what the church ought to be. And so he had this going, and he wasn't a popular guy at all. He was the butt of all kinds of jokes, and he was probably a queer-looking fellow too.
Yeah, the journalists really did a rough job on him, and causes two of his comments about journalism. One of them is,
You
think of no greater curse than that he should curse his son that he should grow up to be a journalist. And the other is that if he had the choice between the fact that he had a daughter that should be raped or a son should become a journalist, there would be no choice.
Yeah. Another time he said, the monster is the state, and the state vomits its bile, and that's the press. So he wasn't very, he wasn't very kind to journalists. Well, I want to discuss the one work, Stages on the Way of Life. And if I had a blackboard, I'd have you remember three words. The aesthetic stage, E-S.
Write them down.
Aesthetic stage, the ethical stage, and the religious stage. Those three. Now, this isn't a progression necessarily altogether. That is, a person is not first the aesthetic, and then the ethical, and then the religious, although for purposes of clarification, those are good categories. And I suppose in the Christian term, you'd say that the natural man, the fallen man, the man untouched by God, unredeemed, would be the aesthetic man, or the aesthetic person.
And then the next stage would be the ethical, and the third stage, the religious. Now, he uses the word aesthetic in a different way, or in his own way, not the examining of what's beautiful and what's ugly, which is normally how the Greeks use the term aesthetic, but he says that's the stage, or that's the level, in which a person lives by taste, by what he wants to do, by feeling, if you will, by emotion, but that's not quite right either. It lives by taste. What he likes to do, he does, or he should do. And or, in another way, it's a person who lives outside of the poles of right and wrong, of good and evil. He does not consider good and evil or right and wrong. He ignores those, and his life is determined by what he feels like doing. He does not consider good and evil or right and wrong. He ignores those, and his life is determined by what he feels like doing, which is a combination, Kierkegaard says, of your appetites and your inclinations and your disposition, your on the inside, and the pressures or the lack of pressures of the world on the outside. That's the aesthetic stage. Best illustrated probably by a dog. If a dog sees a bone, and it starts for the bone, and then on the way he sees a bigger dog coming toward the bone, the first dog stops and doesn't take the bone. Now you can describe that this way. You can say in the first instance the dog decided to take the bone, and in the second instance he reconsidered and decided not to take the bone. Now, the fact of the matter is he made no decision at all. The dog was driven to the bone by appetite, by the appetite of hunger, in the first instance, and then in the second instance, out of the environment or out of the world, arose another tyrant, which created the tyrant of fear. And fear had the longer whip, and fear controlled the situation. It's preposterous to say that the dog made any decision. The distinctive thing about the human being is that he can make decisions, that God made him that way, and therefore he can sin, like Carol said. Now, the human being, let's say a man walks down the street, and he sees the man in front of him drop or lose his billfold. Now, he knows the man. He knows that the billfold is probably full of money because the man is rich. And he says to himself, this is my lucky day. This man doesn't need the money. I need the money. And he's about to pick up the billfold when out of the corner of his eye, he notices a policeman standing there watching the whole procedure. And he picks up the billfold, all right, but he hurries and overtakes the man and gives him his billfold back. And the policeman says to himself, I'm glad there are honest people in the world still. Now, the fact of the matter was that he behaved identically the same way as the dog behaved. He was driven to pick it up by his need or desire for money. He was deterred or shifted his course or stopped or reconsidered because of the bigger dog that appeared in the environment. Now, where a person is controlled by his desires, which are, in Kierkegaard's picture, just a big bag of stuff, a kind of anarchy, a chaos of things. Sometimes you're driven by one thing and sometimes by another. There's no consistency at all. So therefore, you think you're free, but you're not free at all. I think when Satan imprisons us in his prison, he allows us the delusion of freedom. We're able willy-nilly to let any one of the many tyrants take over. Appetite, lust, avarice, and particularly since all these gods or goddesses, these tyrants, are in the Parthenon of self. Mm-hmm. You don't have to worry about who takes over. And the person living that way has the impression that he's free to do what jolly well he wants to do, when the fact of the matter is he's only the pawn in an anarchy or a chaos of tyrants that control him. Not a slogan, but a statement that Kierkegaard uses in the aesthetic stage is that the talent is the call. The talent is the call. If you've, and I would say that most of the vocational guidance of our day probably falls right there. If you're good at math, and you like math, you ought to be an engineer. If you're good at public speaking or at articulation, and you like to do it, you ought to be an auctioneer or a preacher. The idea is that this is the call. The talent is the call. And now, of course, that's basically, I think in many instances, it's a good guide. And I'm not deploring the fact that it's used. But there is something different. There is something other than that. And it's basically wrong. Supposing a man is good at robbing banks and he loves to rob banks, he doesn't have a call to rob banks. Or if he likes to seduce his neighbor's wives and he's good at it, he doesn't have a calling to do it. The whole idea is that you do what you jolly well want to do. And that's basically wrong. Now, we had a fellow come to the seminary a few years ago, and he had a straight 4.0, and he was a major in physics and math, and he had Danforth scholarships to MIT and to Chicago, Chicago Tech. Anyway, here he came to the seminary, and I said, "What in the world did you come here for with that?" Well, he said, this was very interesting. He said, I have a little stuttering problem. And I wanted to be a pastor. I felt a call to be a pastor, but I thought that circumstance was enough to prevent me from doing that kind of work. So I went into science, and then I got conned, and as a junior, I got conned into taking part in college debating. And in my last year of college, I was voted the best debater in the college. And I thought the signs of the zodiac had shifted. You know, so here he was. Well, he's ending up with two professions. He finished the seminary and is getting his PhD after all in science, and then let the chips fall where they will. But the idea is that there is an ought there somewhere. I ought to do this, not because I want to do it or because the world wants me to do it, but because I ought to do it, between the right and wrong. Now, it's possible, I think, for a person to live, and Kierkegaard would say that, you can live your whole life through on this aesthetic level. It is, whether it's actually done, I think it is. Supposing a person is born, he doesn't decide to get born. And he eats not because he decides to eat, but because he cries and somebody gives him food. Age 5 or 6, he goes to school. He doesn't decide to go to school. The social pressures put him in school. He discovers in school that that the pressures are for his studying, because his parents are more pleased, nicer to live with, and his teacher is nicer to live with if he studies. So he studies. And finally, he graduates from the university cum laude, or summa cum laude, because he's yielded to all these pressures, after all, and never quite had the guts to flunk. He just did what the pressures said he ought to do. And then he gets married, and he ought to stand at the altar and shake himself and ask how he got there, because he probably never made a decision to get there. He drifted up there. And then he goes to work and succeeds, and after a while, the people tell him he ought to run for the Senate. So he runs for the Senate, and he makes it. And he has a distinguished career as a senator, because he always listens well to what the electorate wants him to do, what the dogs out there are telling him. And then one day he dies. He didn't decide to die. And then he finds himself in hell. He didn't decide to go to hell either. But the fact of the matter was, he never decided once anything. He thought he did, but he never did. So it's possible, Kierkegaard would say, to live this on this level.
Two plays you should know that are built on this, incidentally, and out of the inspiration of Kierkegaard by Ibsen, Peer Gynt and Brand.
Yeah.
So I'm going to describe these two sides.
I won't pick up Brand at this point, but Peer Gynt, let me pick him up. In this play, Peer Gynt, a young Norwegian, in the first part of the play, he's at a wedding. It's not his wedding, it's his friend's wedding. And in Norway, they have a wedding party that lasts several days, and during those days, he becomes enamored of the bride, and the bride becomes enamored of him, and when nobody looks, they run away with each other. And a very nasty trick to play on the bridegroom. And then after a while, after a few days, he kind of tires of her, and moreover, the police are after him, the dogs are out, and so he drops her. And takes passage for America. While a boy, looking at the clouds drifting overhead, he had two dreams. One was the dream that he might become rich, and the other the dream that he might become an emperor. Well, Ibsen has him become rich in the United States in the slave traffic, and he gives a little money to buy New Testaments for the Africans. But he becomes rich, and then he drifts down to Cairo, Egypt. And in Cairo, Egypt, on the streets, he is mistaken for an escaped lunatic. And the guards pick him up and put him in the insane asylum. And there he lives for a while. And while he's there, the lunatics elect him their emperor. Now, that wasn't quite the empire he'd planned. Then he drifts, Ibsen has him drift back to Norway. And the first person he meets in Norway is the button maker. He's a fellow who has raw materials in a pot and boils the material and shapes buttons. And this button maker, a philosophical kind of guy, says to Peer Gynt, you were always a defective button, Peer. You never turned out right. I think what we'll have to do is to put you in the pot and boil you over again and see if we can't come up with a good button. And Peer Gynt understands what he's driving at, and he says, I admit that I haven't done what I ought to have done, and I've done a lot of things I shouldn't have done, and I deserve to be punished. But I won't consent to be put in the pot and boiled over again, because the button that comes out will not be myself. It'll be another button, and I will not consent to lose my selfhood. And the button maker said, now, Peer, don't get excited. You've never been a self. You've got nothing to lose. You've never been a self. All through your life, you've been the accidental result at any given point of what this chaotic mixture of appetites and desires and lusts on the inside have dictated for you to do, and what the environment on the outside has allowed you to do or has dictated for you to do. You've never defied your appetites and inclinations on the one hand, and defied the environment or the world on the other hand, and in defiance of both, decided to do something because it's right. You've never done that. And Pierce said, no, that isn't true. And so he goes in search of witnesses. He goes to his friends, and none of them will testify that he ever has made a decision in defiance of what he wanted to do and what the world wanted him to do or let him do. And finally, he's driven, or the Ibsen has him go to the devil, to ask the devil to testify that he, Peer Gynt, at some time or another, did decide to do the wrong thing. He didn't always drift. He made a decision to do the wrong thing. And the devil, in effect, replies that you've always done the wrong thing, and I kind of appreciate that, but you've never been man enough to decide to do the wrong thing. So he couldn't testify either. It was as if to say that so up to this point, Peer Gynt is not a self. He's not a self. He has no integration. From one moment to another, he's not the same. From one day to another, he's not the same. He's only the accident that results of all these forces coming together. He is under the illusion that he decides, but he never decides. Well, that's the aesthetic level, and it's a very fascinating level. I think of the fallen state of man, where man believes that he is in command, that he can do what he wants to do. And all the time, what he wants to do is what his passions tell him to do, or what the pressures of the world tell him to do. And so he is in bondage to the devil, the world, and his own flesh, or whatever, however you describe that. He thinks he's free, but he isn't free. He lives on this aesthetic level. Now, Kierkegaard has this book, Either Or, where the first part of it is an autobiography of a seducer, and the second part of the book is letters from a friend, a kind of judge. A friend of the seducer, trying to persuade him not to live on the aesthetic level anymore, but to leave the aesthetic level and choose. It's a fascinating device that Kierkegaard uses. He makes the aesthete, the guy, the seducer, a very brilliant, attractive person. He makes the judge, his friend, a rather dull, prosaic person. But the point of it is that, dull and prosaic as he is a self, or he is the truth, while this brilliant person, despite his brilliance and attractiveness, is lost. And the autobiography of the seducer, I remember Jerry Pelican saying, why wouldn't it be fun to have some publisher publish that with that title and put it on the bookshelves with a lurid picture and lure somebody into buying it, only to have them discover that it's a highly psychological, philosophical study, and that the actual seduction is dismissed with a sentence. And you have none of the stuff that you get from the commonly advertised books of that character. Well, anyway,
it should be said too that this has been translated in practically every language that people read in.
Oh, I suppose that's one of the first ones.
Yeah. And unfortunately, some of them never get published.
Well, that's one title. It'd be all right for everybody to read too. Anyway, coming to the ethical level. Now here Kierkegaard says a person decides that from henceforth he will do what's right and and eschew or deny what's wrong. Almost like if you put it in religious terms, it's what Joshua said to his people when he took over. Choose you this day whom you will serve. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. You put yourself in the world of choice. But from now on, my course is to be decided, not by what I want, nor by what the world wants, but by what's right. That's what's going to determine my course of action from now on. Well, Kierkegaard says at that point, a person becomes a self. Now he's an integration. Now he has identity. Now he's on the way to being, if you want to use the term, fulfilled. Up to this point, he has no chance. He's just a piece of debris, flotsam, being pushed around for 70 years or more or less on this chaotic stream of his own passions and the whims of society. Now he has a chance, but he runs into problems. It's not very simple. He sallies forth in the morning and night on a white steed to do what's right and to abstain from what's wrong with high resolution, and he comes back every night tarnished and crushed because the high resolutions that he made did not materialize. And he tries this day after day. Now, if he's not fooling himself, he only discovers that the gap between what he ought to be and what he is gets bigger and bigger. Now, this gap between what he is and what he ought to be, that's where all the fears and the anxieties and the bad things of life may be. How are you going to handle the gap between what a person is and what he ought to be, or what he pretends to be and what he is? This world of pretense. And since he's dealing honestly with this matter, he discovers at the end of the day that he didn't narrow the gap at all. In fact, if he's under the tutelage of the Holy Spirit, or if he's taking seriously right and wrong, the gap only seems to widen because he becomes more sensitive to what is demanded of him. And, of course, especially if he's under the law of God or under the law of love or whatever, the gap becomes wider and wider. And he reaches the point that Paul describes: the good I would, I do not; the evil I would not, that I do. O wretched man, who will deliver me from the body of this death? The whole situation. It's impossible for me to live as an ethical creature. Now, of course, again, we can tailor the demand to a modest demand and probably escape this despair. After all, I led a life, I was an alcoholic, and I passed bad checks, and I did this and I did that, and now I no longer do it. So probably I can build a kind of self-respect on that level. But if a person, as Kierkegaard says, is under the tutelage of God, all this patching will not do. And it's only the Christian who will never really say, I did the best I could. I did my best. Like Herb Butterfield, the historian, the Christian historian, says, that's the saving thing about society, about the Christian in society, is that that's the only philosophy or the only point of view that blocks a person from ever saying, I did the best I could, or I did my best, because a person knows he never did his best. You know, I suppose a runner in a race might say, well, I did the best I could, but he'll probably re-examine that and say, had I trained just a little better, I would have won the race, or something. But the Christian is guarded against this pretense of having done okay, by never being able to say, I did the best I could. Under this terminology, he is undone. He is undone. Who shall deliver me from the body of this death? At that point, Kierkegaard says, you can go three routes. You can go back to the ascetic and say, it won't work. You know, I give it up. Or you can go a kind of a side detour into what he calls the category of humor. He puts humor between the ethical and the religious. That's a fascinating place to put it. That the Christian or the person who is drawing close to God, he has a sense of humor. Now, what does he mean by that? Going back to the gap, he'll say that which makes for tragedy in the gap is that which also makes for comedy. That the tragic is the comic turned around. And the best illustration, probably not the best, but one illustration at least, is a drunken man. If he's hanging to a telephone pole and you come upon him suddenly and you find that he's stroking the pole and speaking endearingly to it, the immediate reaction is to chuckle. There you have the gap between what he is and what he ought to be, what he pretends to be and what he is. You come a little closer and discover that it's your brother or your husband or your son or somebody dear to you, and suddenly you want to cry. You're not chuckling anymore. You want to cry because the gap has tragedy and comedy in it. Now, it's very important for me to get release in humor. Very important for me to get released there, to not take myself so seriously that it's always going to cause tears, that I can turn it around a little and laugh at myself or laugh at you when things are bad. And the whole human situation is like that. And after all, the only creature that God gave the gift of laughter to was us. He didn't give it to the hyena, much as we may think so. Only we can laugh, and therefore it must have been given us for a purpose, to chuckle. And this sense of relief from humor, of seeing the very tragic situation as a very funny situation, is kind of the release valve, let's say. But you can't go chuckling all your life through. So the third alternative is the religious one, where the gap is bridged, not by your efforts, but by somebody else's efforts, by Jesus Christ, and that to that which you ought to be, in him you are. That is, the righteous, the forgiveness wipes out the gap. The righteousness of Christ given to us by grace through faith just bridges the gap. So I stand before God now with no gap at all. I stand with boldness because the gap has been taken away. I am what I ought to be in his sight through Christ, through God's own action in grace. Now there's just no question but what that's the profoundest, I was going to say psychological observation, but it's the profoundest thing about the Christian faith, is handling this gap that is common to humanity. There's no escaping that. I don't know if Peer Gynt or anybody like him, I suppose, have twinges at times. However hard you try to destroy conscience or destroy any sense of right and wrong, I suppose it's possible. That's what Colson said when he was asked, and all this nasty business of Watergate, didn't it ever occur to you that you were wrong? And he said, no, it never occurred to me that there was any right or wrong. He was loyal to the system. He was observing the dogs out there. They were telling him what to do, and he was obedient, and things were all right. Now, I suppose it's possible. But if you've ever been touched by right and wrong, if that's begun to stir, and particularly if a person has committed himself to try, then the only way of escape is grace alone or the religious. And in Luther's terms, I think Luther is thoroughly Pauline and thoroughly Augustinian in this stages on the way of life. And there comes the great release. Your sins, though they be scarlet, are white as snow. Though they be crimson, they are as wool. As far as the east is from the west, so far have I taken them away. They aren't there anymore. There's a complete reconciliation, complete that which I ought to be, I am, in Christ Jesus. Now that frees me from the dead-end street that I got hooked up with in the ethical stage. You know, I got to a dead end. There was no way to go. Now the way is opened again, and I'm no longer carrying the cargo of guilt and fear and this all this stuff over against God. I've been cleared of that. Now I'm free, in a sense, to re-enter the ethical world. I suppose, Carol, would that be called the third use of the law sometimes by the boys? Anyway, whatever you call it. It isn't as if I'm set free now to do jolly well what I please, or willy-nilly what I want to do, because now I'm captured by this marvelous person who bridged the gap, who made it right. And while I'm not under the imperatives of the law, I'm under the imperatives of something that has gotten in there somewhere. My gratitude to him for his love has built in it a kind of imperative of love, or the liberty, the law of liberty, or whatever. So that I'm back in the whole field of the ethical, right and wrong, good and evil, with all in a much profounder way than before, because now it's gotten tied up with my liberator, Jesus Christ, and the passion of love that dominates him. And so I am under one towering law, when before I was trying to justify myself in all kinds of rules. But it's a very fascinating description of what I suppose is happening in every Christian's life. I don't see how you can escape any one of these categories if you're a Christian. I ask myself, how many decisions do I make on the aesthetic level?